You're listening to The Lyric Feature on RTE Lyric FM.
Good evening and welcome to The Lyric Feature. In 2020, when composer Sean Doherty was unexpectedly reconnected with the traditional Irish music that he had grown up with, it became the start of a quest to find out more about Francis O'Neill, Chicago police chief and collector of Irish music. This is 1001 Gems.
There's a busy pub in Chicago called Chief O'Neill's, owned by husband and wife, Brendan and Siobhan McKinney. They met through music.
I met my husband at the Milwaukee Irish Fest because he's a musician and I'm a musician. I play the flute and he plays the flute and pipes.
Like so many people, Brendan and Siobhan had the idea of opening an Irish pub. But unlike most people, they actually went ahead and did so. And since they opened their pub in 1999, it's become a mecca for musicians and fans of Irish music who live locally and for visiting Irish musicians.
We've had, you know, so many musicians come through. I mean, you know, the Chieftains and Matt Malloy, you know, we have had so many people come through and play and perform.
As the pub is called Chief O'Neill's, there's one question that Siobhan is constantly being asked.
Is the chief here?
We're like,
oh, okay. He hasn't been here for a while.
Visitors to the pub would have trouble meeting the chief because Francis O'Neill was born in 1848 and died back in 1936. But his name is still remembered in the history of Chicago and in Irish traditional music circles. I'm Sean Doherty. I'm a composer. I write new music for choirs, string quartets, orchestras, opera. But in this programme, I'm going to be telling a story from the world of Irish traditional music about the collector Francis O'Neill. Researching O'Neill's life and works brought me back to the music that I grew up with, back to Irish traditional music. This wasn't something that I'd planned. It was an accident, born out of a family tragedy, that brought me back to O'Neill and his collections, to forgotten memories of my childhood, to the US to follow in O'Neill's footsteps, and to delve into a new area of music research. O'Neill's story begins in Cork, and I met Nicholas Carlin, former director of the Irish Traditional Music Archive and author of A Harvest Saved, Francis O'Neill and Irish Music in Chicago, to hear about O'Neill's early years.
Well, he was born in Tralibon, which is in the mountains in West Cork, near Bantry, about 3 miles from Bantry. He was from a reasonably well-to-do family from the area. His father and his uncles leased and owned quite a bit of land there. So he would be what you'd call a middle-class person nowadays, you know.
And what sort of music would he have been exposed to growing up?
Oh, entirely traditional music, all oral tradition music. His mother was a singer and he transcribed or had transcribed about 400 tunes that she sang or lilted around the house. His father was a singer. Sisters were singers. One of the sisters married to a champion dancer and so on. And of course there were dances held in their house. They had a substantial house in Tralibon and there were regular dances there. And O'Neill as a child remembered, 50 years later, remembered the tunes that he could hear coming through the wall when he was sent to bed.
What made him leave all that and go to America?
Well, ambition, and I think he was chafing at the monotony of country life, especially, seemingly, a new local priest had sort of suppressed music and dancing, and this didn't go down well with the need. But I'd say largely ambition. He went from Trallyban every day into Bantry to attend school, and he would have seen the ships and the boats coming and going into Bantry Bay. So he signed up to a ship, and in 1865 undertook to sail the seven seas, went to Egypt, Russia, South America, North America, of course, the West Indies. He'd sailed around the Cape of Good Hope by the time he was 21. He'd traversed the globe.
One of O'Neill's many sea voyages turned into quite the adventure.
He was shipwrecked in the Pacific, and they were wrecked on a coral island and were without food, and the crew was starving. Now, they were picked up and rescued by a ship that was manned by Kanakas or Kanakas, you know, native people, and one of them had a flute, but he could only play a simple single strain melody, and O'Neill, as a flute player, showed him what could be done with Irish music on the flute, and the shipman shared his rations with O'Neill. O'Neill was one of the three sailors who didn't have to go to hospital when they were brought to California.
You could say Irish music saved his life.
It did, yes, yeah.
Another voyage changed his life when he met a young woman on board.
She was from Fecal, Anna Rogers was her name, and he was serving on a ship that she was an emigrant on. She was coming from County Clare to North America. They made acquaintance there, they kept in touch, and they eventually married in Chicago.
This is my kind of town, Chicago.
Chicago is an absolute boomtown. It's relatively recent, and it is just exploding. There are people coming every day. There are rail lines converging there. It's a very dynamic and very innovative city.
This is Mike O'Malley, professor of history at George Mason University in Virginia, and author of The Beat Cop, Chicago's Chief O'Neill, and the Creation of Irish Music.
If you're an Irish immigrant, what could you be? Well, you'd go into construction, as a lot of people did. You could, in that way, you could become a contractor, or you could become a union leader, or you could join the police or fire department.
Francis O'Neill chose the police force and joined up in 1873.
So he gets on the police force. He's on probation for a while. He's shot in the line of duty. In his first 2 weeks on probation, a burglar shoots him in the shoulder, and he recovers. It's not a fatal wound. And that seals his position on the police force.
And he rose through all the various degrees of authority within the police, became the secretary to the general superintendent, who would be the chief of police, and eventually himself became chief of police in 1901, and was reappointed twice, which was unheard of. And he was reappointed simply because he was doing a good job.
As O'Neill's biographers, both Mike O'Malley and Nicholas Carlin have studied O'Neill at length, and read his own words and what others have said about him. They've each formed a strong impression of O'Neill's character.
He's very interested in respectability. He's a respectable guy. He's church-going, upper-middle-class, well-educated by the standards of his time, sober person of sober habits. He's an odd guy. He doesn't drink, he doesn't smoke, he doesn't gamble. He's an abstemious man. But I think he's also very likable. He has a good, dry sense of humor. And I think he has demonstrable character. And people recognize that in him.
As a policeman, he was very strong-minded. He would make a decision. He would stick to it. He disciplined policemen who were loafers, as he called them, and so on. At the same time, he was, in private life, shy, scholarly person, interested in music, of course, but also in art and literature and so on, and had a huge library. So there were the two sides to him.
It was through O'Neill's connection with music that I first heard of him. I was 10 years old and on a trip to Belfast with my mummy to buy my first full-sized violin.
I spent hours in the music shop, trying out all the violins and bows and choosing the instrument that I most liked. Along with the new bow, case and rosin, the shop assistant recommended that if I liked trad, I should have one book in particular. The Dance Music of Ireland, 1001 Gems, collected from all available sources and edited by Captain Francis O'Neill. The shop assistant was right. This is arguably the single most influential collection in Irish traditional music, sometimes known simply as the Book or the Bible.
I think he was somebody who had recognised, having left Ireland, that Irish music itself was in decline. At least that's the story he tells us in his writings.
This is Dr. Aileen Delan, Associate Professor of Music in the Irish World Academy of Music and Dance at the University of Limerick.
And I also think when he arrived in Chicago, it was an extraordinary moment, and you had all of these musicians from Ireland who had migrated, and from other parts of America actually as well, who had migrated to the city for work. So he had this extraordinary hinterland of really capable and interesting and talented musicians with a vast array of repertoires. And I think he saw this opportunity to not just collect music from all of these people to enliven and breathe new life into the tradition itself, but also maybe to make a statement himself about the nature of tradition.
O'Neill described in his book, Irish Music, A Fascinating Hobby, how he went about collecting tunes. Here's one story.
One summer evening in 1875, the strains of a fiddle coming through the shutters of an old dilapidated building on Cologne Street attracted my attention. The musician was an old man named Dylan, who lived alone and whom I'd seen daily wielding his long-handled shovel on the street. His only solace in his solitary life beside his doudine was Jenny, as he affectionately called his fiddle. A most captivating jig memorised from his playing, I named Old Man Dylan in his honour.
O'Neill had a prodigious memory for tunes, and certainly, in the early years, didn't have sufficient skill in reading and writing music to transcribe the tunes himself. He enlisted the help of a fellow musician and police officer, who also happened to be called O'Neill, although he was no relation, James O'Neill.
James wrote down the tunes that Francis would whistle or lilt or play for him. And first of all, it was a matter of preserving the music of his mother. And then the thing grew enormously, in fact, over many years. They started in the late 1880s. And O'Neill's first book wasn't published until 1903. Because, of course, they were policemen at the time, working all day, sometimes all night. And they had to drop everything to answer the call of duty.
Let's think for a moment of some of the skills that O'Neill acquired as a police officer as new methods of detective work were being developed.
He was very active in, very enthusiastic about the revolution that was going on in forensic technology, in identity tracking. And I want to stress this again, Chicago is a booming city, so there are new people coming in every day. So if you have crime, you have a serious problem in tracking who are these people. Is this the guy we arrested before? Who is this guy? What's his real name? Did he give us a false identity? So their first step is the invention of the mugshot, the photograph. They call it the rogues gallery. And O'Neill is very involved in working with the captain who's in charge of that operation. And then they develop more refined systems of identity tracking, something called the Bertillon system, Bertillon, a Frenchman, who is eager to measure things about people that never change. So, you know, the distance of your eyes apart will never change. The length of your forearm to the tip of your finger will never change. He has an index of measurements that he wants people to take. And O'Neill is so enthusiastic about this that he gives seminars to other policemen, a sort of school, they call it, for forensic technology.
O'Neill seems to have taken a similar systematic approach to collecting Irish tunes.
The tunes are often very similar. And how do you tell one tune from another? What's just a personal variation on a standard tune and what amounts to a different tune? And often he would find, of course, the tunes have multiple names or sometimes no name. And he'd have to give them a name, or he'd have to determine if this tune is actually another tune, or, oh no, that's the B part of this tune, which has been grafted onto the A part of this other tune. It's actually quite a massive forensic identity tracking effort. Very similar, I think, to the effort of tracking criminals or potential criminals or suspects. He's interested in that kind of work. He finds comfort, I think, for his orderly mind in that kind of work.
He organized his tunes according to type. So he would put jigs in one section, reels in another section. He was also very, very aware of the need to cross-reference. So he would have indices and he would have different ways of getting to the tunes, each of which were numbered. And if you take a typical page from his collections, it's not one tune and variations. It's one outline of a tune, and then stacked upon it is another one above it and another one above it and another one above it. So it's extraordinarily densely packed.
O'Neill encountered some obstacles as he went about collecting tunes.
Irish people in Chicago did not want to share their tunes. They feel that the tunes belong to them personally. It's their party piece, or it's their, you know, they remember it from home. It belongs to their townland back in Ireland. They aren't eager to share their tunes, particularly for a collection that none of them were asking for. It's not like the people of Ireland were begging, oh, please write these down in a big book that I can't afford. There was no great cry for that. So when he came to them and said, I'm publishing this great book that it's going to include all the tunes, and often the response was sort of resistance or head scratching.
This is where the role of police chief could come in useful.
He uses his authority as a police chief to do this collection. He referred to it as the authority of the badge. This collection would only have been possible with the authority of the badge. And by that he meant the intimidation that a police officer could bring to an individual encounter, but also the fact that he could have his lieutenants and his sergeants and his patrolmen on the lookout for tunes. And people would come to him and say, we found a guy in the stockyards who knows a lot of tunes. And O'Neill would go see the guy. Are these original tunes? And if he could, he'd try to write them down. He was not averse to having people sort of hide, you know, and listen to the tune until they memorize it and then take it back without asking.
There had been other collections of Irish music made before O'Neill's, but often these were difficult to come by and kept in places like the archives of universities or other institutions.
O'Neill was the one who put the music into the hands of practicing musicians, especially through his 1001 collection.
That's the key point of O'Neill, is he made it accessible.
That's right.
For the general public.
That's right, that's right. It's raw material for analysis, for learning, and it's a well that we still draw on.
I was too young to draw from this well when I was given O'Neill's 1001 gems at the age of 10. I remember being fascinated by the strange names of many of the tunes, like Boiled Goat's Milk, Cheer Up Old Hag, Go to the Devil and Shake Yourself, Knee Buckle Jig. And I remember poring over the book, trying to decipher the dense lines of notation, trying to hear the tunes in my head, and using my shaky grasp of music notation to pick out the notes one by one. But the tunes seemed stiff and square. They didn't sound like the tunes I'd learned by ear from my teacher. The book just left me frustrated, and it was relegated to a shelf in my bedroom where it lay unopened for over 20 years. But if my first experience of O'Neill was frustrating, the experience of fiddle player Martin Hayes was much more positive. Martin, as you may know, is from just outside Feakill in County Clare.
Well, his wife, Frances O'Neill's wife, was from Feakill. So, you know, like, as you probably know about traditional music in Clare, we try to claim everything, you know. So we kind of like, we have a little tentative connection to Frances O'Neill, so we claim it, you know. But yeah, but I do like to think that Frances O'Neill did wander around Feakill, and there are certain tunes like the Maids of Feakill and the Humours of Scariff and various tunes like that that I would think, you know, well, maybe he got them when he was there. And Johnny Allen's real. Johnny Allen was a well-known musician back at that time around Feakill. So there is a little bit of the music of the locality, you know, in O'Neill's collection, I think.
When's the first time you would have heard of Frances O'Neill and the collections?
I would have heard about O'Neill when I was a child. Now, my father didn't read music, so, like, O'Neill's book was not a factor in our household. But Paddy Kenny did read, and another friend of his, Sean Reid, read lots of music. And another fiddle player that I was influenced a lot by was Martin Rochford, and he was a great reader of manuscripts, not just O'Neill's, but any manuscript he could get, like Scottish manuscripts, everything. So there was a lot of talk about it, because, like, those musicians from the generation before, from my father's generation, like, they were desperate to get melodies, and they were desperate enough to learn to read music in order to get the melodies. So when you hear about Irish musicians, like, of that generation, or even in the case for myself, reading music, we're not real readers as such, but we have enough capacity usually to decipher the melody from O'Neill's book. So that the search for the tune was kind of like central, you know, for those people. There were recordings coming out, but not enough to satisfy the hunger.
As for me, I'd given up on O'Neill when I was 10 and instead satisfied my own hunger for musical knowledge by learning classical violin and playing in a youth orchestra. I discovered my love for choral music and realised my secret ambition to be a composer. Then, some 20 years later, my brother's death brought me back to my childhood bedroom. It was April 2020. At the start of the pandemic. My big brother, Brendan, had died suddenly and unexpectedly of a heart attack. I returned home to Derry from Dublin to be with my parents for the nightmarish scenes of a funeral in lockdown. We were shut in at home, and I needed something to stop me doom-scrolling on my phone. So, from the shelf, I took down the book that I'd left there 20 years before, The Dance Music of Ireland, 1001 Gems, and turned to the first tune in the book, Shandon Bells. With 20 years of study and experience, it wasn't daunting anymore. I just started to analyse the tunes, looking for wee motifs, like you would do a word search or Sudoku. By the end of the first page, I saw that the patterns of the tunes were even more regular than I'd anticipated. So I was struck by a line in Martin Hayes' autobiography, Shared Notes, where he described how tunes live in my memory as remembered patterns.
The tune is kind of like some abstract pattern inside you somewhere that's kind of in your nervous system, in your body, like it exists in your physicality in a way, you know?
That's exactly how I feel about it. And when I went to the O'Neill collection and I started annotating the tunes, I couldn't believe how regular lots of the pieces were.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the structures of traditional music are relatively simple, relatively straightforward, and very, very consistent. I mean, there are, you know, some variations of it, of course. But, you know, when you look at the manuscript, you're seeing a bar, a bar, a bar. I'm thinking a conversation. And usually, you know, these tunes start with like a little, it could be you know, just a kind of a beginning opening statement, you know. It really defines the melody. It could be di-deedle-do-deedle-dum-ba-deedle-deedle-dum. But then you'll find that there's almost always an answer. Di-deedle-do-deedle-deedle-dum. So there's a conversation, there's like this call and answer that you hear in the melodies. And that usually, you know, it can be a call and answer. It can be go back and make the same call again with a slightly different answer, you know. And then you'll go to the B part of the tune, which kind of mirrors the A part, but it stands in contrast and often follows the same formula, but usually with a distinctive end that reaches this, a beautiful conclusion by playing the beginning of the melody again. And so it creates this circular momentum in the tune that you want to repeat it, and it wants to flow in a circle.
And I think The Cat in the Corner is a great example of what you just said about the call and response. You've got the call, and then...
Yeah.
Similar to the first two bars,
yeah.
But just a little different, and then back to the first two bars. With a...
So they're relatively simple, they're very conversational, they're kind of like, you know, if we were to make a comparison to literature or something, they're like a haiku, you know, there's a lot of limitations, there's a fairly strict order to the structure of the tunes. But those limitations, nonetheless, and almost all artists would say it, like, are your friend, you know, like they guide you to some place. And so it's good to have some limitations. A blank sheet is a terrible thing. I mean, what was interesting for me was that I actually composed a few tunes, and without ever having an analytical, theoretical understanding of the structure of the tunes, when I went to compose a tune, I automatically composed within the structure, even without thinking, you know. And so I suppose if you grow up with that music or are very familiar with it, you simply internalize that idea without ever really knowing that it exists, I suppose, you know.
I understand now that I'd internalised these patterns when I was a child. I have a memory of being in a class at Glencolum Kilfiddle Week when I got the pet name of the human tape recorder because of my knack of learning a new tune after one or two hearings. To me, this wasn't an unusual talent, because once you know the first bit of each part, you sort of know how the rest is supposed to go. Now, as an adult, I began to wonder more about the patterns in the tunes, coming up with my own method to label each pattern. I started to analyse the tunes in O'Neill's 1001 Gems one by one. Let me explain the method I devised. Listen to this little pattern from the first tune in O'Neill's 1001 Gems, the Dance Music of Ireland. This is Shandon Bells. That's the first bar. This is the second bar. It's different. So we can call the first bar A and the second bar B. The third bar goes like this. That's very similar to the first bar. So we can call that a variation on the first bar. The fourth bar, different from anything else. But then we have the first bar again, exactly. And then the second bar, exactly again. And just two little bars to finish off the part. So we have the eight bars are divided into four different sub-phrases. A, B, A, C, A, B, D, E. Once I'd broken down the pattern of Shandon Bells, which is the first tune in O'Neill's 1001 Gems, I went on to break down the second one and the third one and so on. After an entire year of this work, I had an enormous spreadsheet breaking down the patterns of all 1001 tunes. What jumped out at me from this spreadsheet was the prevalence of four standard melodic structures common in all tune types: jig, reel, hornpipe. At this stage, I knew that I needed to call on someone with expertise that I didn't have.
I'm James McDermott. I'm a lecturer here in the School of Computer Science in the University of Galway. I'm into music. I've been researching computer music for some decades, sometimes as side projects, sometimes as my main research projects.
I sent James my spreadsheet, hoping that he could help me analyse the data more efficiently.
It's the type of job which, as a computer scientist, I immediately thought, we have to automate this. So Sean sent this big Excel file containing these sentence structures or syntactic structures of all the pieces. We created a visualization of this. I was working with a final year undergrad student, Kieran Jays, and he implemented the visualization.
I was stunned when James first showed me the visualization that they created. On the computer screen, it looked to me like an enormous family tree. And that's how James describes the graph, as a tree, with the root of the tree on the left and the tunes as the leaves of the tree on the right. The app had neatly grouped and organised the data according to its melodic patterns. What would have taken me a lifetime to do manually, the algorithm could do in the blink of an eye. You could see immediately how many different tunes shared exactly the same structure, while others had structures that were entirely unique.
We created these groupings by clustering together tunes which not only had identical, but also tunes which had similar structures. So that's what we see when we see a large group here with identical structures, another group with a different identical structure, but they're similar to each other, and that's why they're close together in the graph, and they join up as we move left in the graph.
The app can also play the tunes, so you can immediately compare them by ear.
We click on any one of those, and then we can listen to it. And this just plays the first eight bars. The structure there was A, B, C, D, A, E, F, G. So just the A bar was repeated, and then the others were slightly different. Sean doesn't have too much interest in the underlying algorithms, perhaps the prefix tree data structure which we used here. But we're interested in those aspects, so we can program those and still produce an output which is potentially useful musicologically to Sean or to another user.
With the help of the computer analysis, I realised that I could take my research further. I could use the tunes in O'Neill's 1001 Gems as a baseline to study the melodic structures of Irish traditional music in general.
The key thing in traditional Irish music are the actual melodies. Some people might think it's the kind of playing, it's how you play, it's the techniques of playing, which is, of course, clearly very important. But the central thing is the melody. And central to the melody is the central structural ideas of the melody. And very soon, when you abandon that, you are actually become unmoored from the whole body of the music very fast. And you create melodies that are not actually, they're questionably connected to this. But like, you could put Irish playing technique down on top of them and they will kind of actually seem like solidly Irish tunes. But there's actually very often, we're missing that simple repetitive pattern and conclusion that makes the conversation of the melody so attractive, you know. You know, I'm open to anything, you know, and I certainly experiment a lot with music myself and break lots and lots of rules. But I do always keep coming back to these structures, and when I want to just simply satisfy myself musically and sit down to play. I love to play these tunes here. You have tunes here like Johnny's Wedding, Loch Allen, you know, the Four Chord. They're all great tunes, you know, that like are just endlessly satisfying, I think.
I agree entirely. You might have new compositions that use the instrumentation or ornamentation or regional style of Irish music, but at the base level,
it's these structures that we all share in common.
That's correct, yeah. Like, so, you're correct. And I think that study you're doing there of those melodies, that's very important. That is actually very important. That is the blueprint of it. Like, that's like the DNA of the music.
Now, I couldn't have Martin Hayes on the programme and not ask him to play a tune from O'Neill's collection.
Are there any tunes in the collection that you particularly like or that you have a history of performing?
Well, there's one tune, like, it's Sergeant Early's Dream, you know, and I realised that Early was one of these people from Chicago. But at the time, I had no idea who this Sergeant Early was or anything, but he was one of my favourite tunes, and I played it all through my teenage years and loved that melody without ever thinking about the word O'Neill, ever thinking about Chicago, ever having any concept about, you know, the name of the tune, Sergeant Early's, or who Sergeant Early was, right? No, you know what? Once I had the name, I didn't care. Like, I was just in the melody. But what a beautiful tune, you know? What a lovely tune for the fiddle, Sergeant Early's Dream. That would be one for sure that, like, is obviously Chicago and O'Neill, you know?
Sergeant James Early, who was one of O'Neill's recruits into the force because he was such a wonderful Irish traditional musician.
Yeah.
And one of the people who went out and transcribed tunes on O'Neill's behalf.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that, and I didn't know his first name either. You know, I just knew the tune, you know.
Going to base my study of Irish traditional music on 1001 gems, I needed to understand exactly how the collection came to be. I wanted to get closer to O'Neill himself and was delighted when an opportunity came up to go to Chicago. One of my first stops was in City Hall, where O'Neill had his office as chief of police. And I felt that I just had to reenact a scene that he described in his autobiography.
I'm in Chicago City Hall right now, outside room 127, where Chief O'Neill had his office. And it's a very imposing building, very ornate, literally gilded, and lots of people around filling out tax forms and paying their parking fines. It was here that John McFadden came to ask Chief O'Neill to whistle him the third part of the tune Paddy in London, because he just completely forgot it from the night before. And it would have sounded something like this.
Agenda was a visit to the University of Notre Dame in South Bend, Indiana, about 2 hours east of Chicago by train.
I'm here in the Hesburgh Library with A.D. Nivoyha Clemens, the subject specialist in Irish studies, and we're here in front of a beautifully written letter in highly ornate script from Francis O'Neill, bequeathing his personal library to the University of Notre Dame. Aideen, tell me a bit about this letter.
It was quite a while in the library before I saw this letter for the first time. It's with a little group of documents that came from Francis O'Neill. And when he sent the letter, he had already been talking to the people in Notre Dame about his personal library. It's clear, that's clear from the letters. And it's written to the president of the university in 1931, which was a while before O'Neill died. And he had been considering where he would put his considerable collection of his music books and also what he called his Hiberniana. And he decided that the University of Notre Dame would be a really good place. And it's clear also from his letters that sharing his books with the community was important to him.
I see that he sends one letter to the president of the university, and the president is quite cautious and says, well, on what terms are you giving this donation? Is there any more outlay for us? And then O'Neill responds saying, no, it's just a donation, it's a gift, please do take it.
Yes, he says, my library is a gift with no obligations imposed but that of their removal with no expense to the donor.
So he really wanted the library, his own personal library, to be used by the students here at the University of Notre Dame. And you can see the your predecessor, a librarian here, a few years later, writes back to O'Neill and says they've been used by the students in the Irish Traditional Music Club. So he really wanted to see, the impression that I get, is that he really wanted that these books be used by the students.
Actually, one of the things that's really nice about Irish traditional music and musicians is the sharing.
It was fascinating to see these letters and the books that he donated to the University of Notre Dame. It was also known that O'Neill had taken advantage of very early recording technology to record some traditional Irish music on wax cylinder. I headed to the Ward Irish Music Archives in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where I learned more about these recordings from the director of the archives, Barry Stapleton, and the broadcaster and historian of Irish music, Harry Bradshaw.
The word was that these had been burned, and the story was that there was a warning during the war years, the Second World War, that is, that people should not have flammable material in their attics because of the risk of Japanese bombing. Now, how Japanese planes were going to get as far inland as Milwaukee is everybody's, you know, it just wasn't going to happen. But anyway, this lady emptied her attic of these cylinders, took them into her yard and burned them. Now, that was the story. So it came as a great shock to everybody. In what year was it, Barry?
So I think I had talked to you about, I think that was around 1999 or 1998. And I felt bad. I thought Milwaukee had done the traditional music community bad, you know. We had burned the cylinders. And so then I think it was 2003. That Dr. David Dunn came in with this suitcase.
In the suitcase were O'Neill's long-lost wax cylinders, which contained some of the earliest recordings of Irish traditional musicians ever made.
On the cylinders, you can see, on some of them, they wrote the actual tune. This is Scotch Mary. And then on them, you'll see here, this is Toohey. It says Toohey, Early, and McFadden. So most of them are just Patsy Toohey by himself, but then there's three or four with Early and McFadden and one with Cronin.
As well as the music performances, they realized that the recordings contained something else. They'd possibly captured the voice of O'Neill himself.
On some of the ones that we have, he does the identification. Doesn't have an Irish accent, doesn't have an American accent. It's a very neutral accent, slightly high in pitch, and announces who's playing and what they're playing. And we're nearly sure we can identify the same voices there, there, and there. So that is most likely the man himself.
A digitized version of a wax cylinder recording made over 100 years ago isn't exactly pristine audio. But I just had to hear O'Neill's voice. Did you catch that? The announcer, who we think is Francis O'Neill, says, "Saddle the pony, James Early." That's the same James Early that I mentioned before, a piper from Leitrim who was a fellow member of the Chicago Police Force and a close friend of Francis O'Neill. I know it's faint, but I still find it thrilling to hear the voice of Francis O'Neill himself. Chicago, there was one particular place associated with O'Neill that I wanted to see.
When you were on the bus, you were coming down towards the cemetery. Was it on your left or on your right? Was the cemetery on the left or on your right before you got off the bus?
The cemetery was on the left.
Okay, perfect. So you were heading west on 111th Street. And then when you turned into the cemetery... I believe you turned south, if I'm not completely mixed up.
Yes, I'm walking, I think, down the cemetery.
I had no idea how enormous the cemetery was at Mount Olivet, but Chicago musician Marta Cook was able to guide me thanks to a video call.
If you go a little bit more slowly with your camera, I think you're walking in the right direction, because I think so far, have you come to any forks in the path?
Before I could pay homage to Francis O'Neill, first I had to find his mausoleum.
Do you see that mausoleum there right in front of you? I don't think that's it. But it's a building that's not dissimilar to that. It's a bit bigger.
I'm continuing on here. I see a couple of mausoleums down here.
Okay.
Here we are.
Oh, perfect. There you go. So you can't really miss it.
Wow. Oh, it's enormous.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's very grand indeed.
The mausoleum is not just a monument to Francis O'Neill. Several members of the family are buried here, and the mausoleum reminds us of the personal tragedies that befell Francis and his wife, Anna.
He actually built the mausoleum originally for his oldest son, Rogers O'Neill, who unfortunately died at the age of 18. Well before his time, and devastated his parents, obviously. And he was obviously a loss, not just of a child, but of a person with a hugely promising future and whom his parents put a great deal of hope. And I think it's probably fair to say that his father, Francis O'Neill, put a lot of hope in him for, like, the future of Irish music in Chicago.
How would you come to terms with the grief that one would feel at the loss of a child on the verge of adulthood, a child of promise on the verge of adulthood? It's devastating. It would be devastating for anyone. There is one hint that in the newspapers where friends feared for his health, you know, after this. And I assume they mean mental health is what they feared for, which is understandable.
Seems an unbearable litany of tragedies for one family. Francis and Anna had already lost 5 of their 10 children, 4 other sons, and a daughter in childhood. 3 of the boys died of diphtheria on the same day. Now they'd lost their eldest son, Rogers O'Neill, at the age of 18, to spinal meningitis. the mausoleum isn't the only monument to his memory. The inside cover of 1001 Gems reads, "Dedicated to the memory of my beloved son, Rogers F. O'Neill, the first member of the Irish Music Club of Chicago, who was called by the great leader to join the heavenly choir."
That death he speaks of in his stoical style as emotionally really devastating. And his wife forbids the playing of Irish music in their house after his death.
It's heartbreaking to think of music in the O'Neill home falling silent after the death of the 18-year-old Rogers in 1904. In the following years, and especially after his retirement from the police force, O'Neill continued his music collecting and publishing. But towards the end of his life, he seems to have become deeply disillusioned. He wondered if the importance of his work hadn't been recognised.
There are testimonies, including from O'Neill himself, that some years later you could find his books in what were basically bargain bins.
He was also worried for the future of Irish music. In a letter to a friend, he wrote, "I was music mad, but the fever has subsided considerably. In fact, I'm cured. Now I'm only angry, disgusted, and pessimistic. The Irish have frittered away their artistic heritage, and in this generation have come to be regarded by the world at large as non-entities in the arts for which they were most distinguished." Fortunately for future generations of Irish traditional musicians, his work was recognised as an enormous achievement.
By publishing the books, and especially the 1907 book, the 1001 Dance Tunes, he made, well, an indelible mark on the tradition. First of all, literate musicians began to learn from it, and then as commercial recording came in, certainly from the 1920s, the musicians went to O'Neill's collection to find tunes to record. Radio began in the 1920s, and they used O'Neill's recorders. The Cayley bands, local heroes who were literate, would teach the music to their illiterate fellow musicians. So it percolated through the entire body of Irish traditional musicians.
Despite O'Neill's fears, Irish music has thrived over the past century.
He was a very large contributing factor, not the only one, but certainly important.
For music researchers like me, his collections, and in particular his 1001 Gems, are an invaluable resource for study. At the start of this journey, I thought 1001 Gems was a standard overview of our musical heritage. But having followed in O'Neill's footsteps, I now see it as a unique snapshot of a living tradition. It comes out of a strange set of circumstances, where the means, motivation, and sheer force of personality of Captain Francis O'Neill drove him on to complete this monumental project in the preservation of Irish traditional music at the crossroads of boomtown Chicago. But above all, the music that O'Neill collected continues to be played and enjoyed, and surely he would be glad to see that Irish traditional music today is thriving in Ireland, across the world, and in his adopted city of Chicago. And I'm ending the programme back where I started, in Chief O'Neill's pub in Chicago, where I joined the session to play Shandon Bells, the first tune in O'Neill's 1001 Gems, the dance music of Ireland.
Thank you. Okay, continue having the crack.
Sean Doherty there performing Shandon Bells in session with musicians at Chief O'Neill's Pub in Chicago, bringing to an end that programme 1001 Gems. Earlier we heard Sean playing The Irish Music Club, The Proposal, The Cat in the Corner, Shandon Bells, Nolan the Soldier and Paddy in London, and we heard Martin Hayes performing Sergeant Early's Dream, all tunes from the O'Neill Collections. 1001 Gems was presented by Sean Doherty and produced by Claire Cunningham. Sound supervision was by Tin Pot Productions, and the programme was a Rock Fringe production for the Lyric Feature and was supported by the RTE Independent Radio Productions Unit with funding from Cumasún na mBan from the television licence fee. The programme is available to podcast on all the usual platforms and on the RTE radio player. And you can also find an article about the making of the programme by Sean Doherty on the RTE Culture page.
You're listening to The Lyric Feature on RTE Lyric FM.
The series producer is Owen O'Kelly, and the production coordinator is Michael O'Kane.